This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We know why sea levels are rising around the world. Hotter oceans mean thermal expansion, and warmer pools are dumping extra water from melting glaciers. Except, now we find out there is a third source of new water into the sea, and it's bigger than each of those. From deep underground to lakes, human actions are pushing Earth's land water into decline. Think what that means for crops, drinking water, and all living things. The paper published July 24th in Science Advances is titled "Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise." We reached co-author Dr. James J. Famiglietti. He is the former director of the Global Institute for Water Security at the University of Saskatchewan and previous senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. From California, J. Famiglietti, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me.
We all heard that wet places get wetter and dry get drier as the world warms, but we pictured some kind of balance. How did your team discover land water sources are actually decreasing?
We used 22 years of satellite data from the NASA GRACE, which stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment Missions. GRACE allows us to track how water storage on the continents and in the ocean and on the ice sheets varies over time. And because we've been monitoring it for over two decades with these satellites, we can see the long-term trends. And that allowed us to see this very startling picture of an increasing amount of continental drying. You mentioned the wet areas getting wetter and the dry areas getting drier. And that's only partially true now. At high latitudes, which used to be under the wet areas get wetter umbrella, we found that those places are melting and permafrost is thawing and they too are getting drier.
When you and I talked in 2014, you told us about declining groundwater under the big food producing state of California. Did last year's atmospheric rivers replenish groundwater supplies there? What is the state of California's water supplies 10 years later?
It's about 10 years worse. We wrote a paper at the end of 2022 that showed that groundwater levels were declining at an accelerating pace rather than slowing down, which one might expect in response to the passage of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The long-term picture in California and in a lot of our food-producing regions is that we use so much water that those regions, those aquifers that underlie those regions, will never be replenished. They get a little replenishment during those wet periods, but that will never compensate for the continued groundwater use during the dry periods.
At least a billion people depend on pumping groundwater, especially as drought becomes more common. On the North Indian Plains, farmers are drilling 100 feet, 30 meters to get water and having to go deeper. How serious is the human role in draining water that accumulated over millennia below ground?
I think that it's poorly appreciated how much a role humans are playing in the continental drying that we report on in the paper. And specifically, I'm talking about groundwater depletion. That's a human decision. It's one that we could cut back on. In California, I live in Arizona now. You know, when I used to live in Saskatchewan, around the world, we are making a decision to pump far more groundwater than is available to us on an annual renewable basis, and it's led to this huge decline that we reported in the paper. So the humans are having an undeniable role and one that we could actually choose to scale back on.
Your study raises another red flag. For years, scientists predicted the far north forests in Canada and Russia would get wetter as the Earth heats up, and you mentioned that. What did you find? I mean, why is this not going to happen?
So last time we wrote a big paper like this one, which was 2018, we had analyzed data, say, from 2002 to 2016. And we did show in those papers that the high-latitude areas were getting wetter and the mid-latitudes were getting drier, just as predicted by the climate models that are used around the world. In this paper, we had an additional 10 years or so of data. and we found that things have really changed, especially over the last decade, and especially at high latitudes. Those are regions that are warming at about four times the global rate, and that's leading directly to snow and ice melt and permafrost thaw. And those phenomena are not really well represented in the climate model. So it's not a surprise to me that the models don't predict it, because the processes are not embedded in the models. The pace of the ice and snow melt and the thawing of the permafrost and its pathway to the ocean to drive sea level rise are not well represented in our models.
Well, here's something that was giving me mental exclamation marks in my brain as I was reading your new paper. Talk to us about the rapid expansion of dry areas and the emergence of mega drying regions.
So again, when we published our last big papers on this topic, and we had a couple of big ones in 2018 and 2016, when we have constructed what we call our global trend map, this global picture of the places that are getting wetter and getting drier. In the places that were getting drier, it was more distinct hotspots and not necessarily interconnected. Over the last 10 years or so, and I keep mentioning this 10-year inflection point around 2014, which was the timing of the biggest El Nino ever recorded. And right about that time, then, we start seeing a rapid increase in the areas around the world that are experiencing extreme drying, more frequent drought. And sort of a complementary impact, we see less of the world getting wetter. So what we're seeing is that the rate of drying is increasing. The area that's experiencing drying and extreme drying is increasing at about two times the size of California each year. And that's been compensated for by the shrinking of the areas that are getting wetter. That also leads then to the connection on a map of the previously very distinct hotspots. And so now when you look between the hotspots, you see a lot more drying. For example, it might be in the United States, California, and the Ogallala Aquifer. And they would have really popped out on a map before. Now, if you look at that global map, you see just a mass of drying across the southwestern U.S., into Mexico, down into Central America, and up even into the northwestern U.S. And so that's led to what we call these mega drying regions. That was an effort on my part to really try to communicate the expanse of the drying and how much it's changed over the last decade.
And the new paper in Science Advances maps out four huge regions of land water loss. The one that caught my eye was in Asia. Could you describe sort of what that mega region includes?
Well, that's a huge region. I mean, it basically goes from northern Africa to northern Europe and from western Europe all the way across to Southeast Asia. And it underscores the expansion of these drying regions from, again, just a small collection of hotspots to a massively interconnected drying landscape. It's, you know, it's basically first steps towards land degradation and desertification. So we really need to be paying attention to this and responding to it at a global scale.
Why didn't I find mega drying in the southern hemisphere, like Australia?
That's a good question. And so we are trying to figure that out. And in the paper, we actually talk about an oscillation, a switch from drying happening mostly in the southern hemisphere to drying happening mostly in the northern hemisphere. So there could be a fundamental change in the climate system, a new oscillation that we point to in the paper. And that is something we're working on right now.
We also have listeners in the UK and Europe. Both have been drier than normal over the past few years, especially Britain. It's remarkable what's happened there this year. And that's a factor in the wildfires there. What did you find out about water loss in Europe, Jay?
Again, relative to these earlier papers that I keep mentioning, we found that the occurrence of drought, especially over the last 10 years in Europe, has really sort of attached, really hit Europe quite hard. and attached it to these, you know, to this mega region. And that's one of the main reasons for the expansion compared to previous papers, was what's been happening in Europe. And of course, when you go there, I was just out there in Stockholm, and I've done a lot of work in Germany. And, you know, it's clear, it's not just something that we're seeing from satellites. It's being experienced, of course, quite significantly on the ground.
Well, let's picture the process, perhaps an agribusiness operation irrigating vast fields with water pumped from underground. So that water evaporates up into the sky and somehow it adds to sea level rise? Why doesn't it just fall again as rain on land?
So there's two things that are happening. So when we pump water out of the ground, what really happens? Well, some of it is embedded in the plant. Some of it infiltrates back down into the ground. A lot of it runs off into rivers and streams that ultimately drain into the ocean. And yes, there's an increase in evaporation. The issue with evaporation in the atmosphere is that the atmosphere doesn't actually store a tremendous amount of water. So it might rain out on land, but ultimately it ends up collecting in the ocean. So again, it gets points to the lack of storage capacity in the atmosphere and the ocean being this ultimate collector for additional water in the water cycle.
Okay, so after a steady diet of ice walls crashing into the sea in Greenland and Antarctica, it's a shock to find even more sea level rise comes from land water loss. If that's true, is water storage in lakes and reservoirs also decreasing?
Yes, it is. The thing about water storage in reservoirs is that it's another human decision, and it's managed by humans, but it certainly fluctuates with how the climate fluctuates. You know, I guess the difference I like to say is one of the big differences between surface water and groundwater is that surface waters in our rivers and our lakes and certain our reservoirs fluctuates. It goes up and down. There's wet periods. There's dry periods. We've got a human management aspect to it. But for the most part, with groundwater, the groundwater just disappears. We use so much of it that we're not replacing it with what happens on the surface.
Your paper does not contain the words peak water, but groundwater and reservoirs can run out. Iran just ran dry. Cities in many parts of the world approached 0 day or had to truck in water. What do you think, Jay? Is peak water a valid worry, or is it too soon for that?
I hesitate to invoke the term peak water because it implies that we know how much groundwater we have, and we actually don't, and that's kind of a startling fact. We know that, of course, we're having huge impacts on the landscape through groundwater depletion. We've got subsidence of the ground surface. We've got falling water tables, degrading water quality, impacts on biodiversity, depleting rivers. So the impacts are all negative. But we don't actually know how much water we have, and that's a challenge. So I tend to stay away from the term peak water, but I will say that there's been a number of studies that have shown that we are well past using easily accessible groundwater.
Why does your team exclude Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets from your definition of continental drying?
That's more a sea level construct. The sea level community likes to split those off, and because they're so huge, because they're such major contributors to sea level rise, also because they're well measured not only by the GRACE satellites but by other satellites. So it really sort of helps us fit into the well-established sea level change studies that are embedded in the global change community.
Well, would it be true to say this generation is burning through water essential for life that cannot be replaced? I mean, is this another generational issue where humans are kind of using up the future?
Certainly it is with respect to groundwater. Groundwater is a intergenerational resource. It took, you know, tens of thousands and more years to accumulate that water in the world's aquifers, and in most cases around the world, we're burning through it in about a century. We are putting future generations and current generations at risk. And that's an important message for people to really understand. We need to be thinking about, in every country around the world, how we can sustain this groundwater for future generations. And it is particularly important in the drying regions of the world, where, in my opinion, you know, especially in the already arid regions that are getting drier, in my opinion, groundwater is the most precious natural resource. And you're right, we're burning through it at far too rapid a clip.
Your paper does end with a call to action. Your team attempts to separate that action from the slower moving climate change to the active problem of continental drying. How would that work? And on a practical level, Jay, what can be done better?
Around the world, I think that every country and states and provinces within countries around the world really need to think carefully about their groundwater management. In many places around the world, the monitoring and the management of groundwater is weak and in some cases non-existent. And so that has to change. At the global scale, it's really, really important that we elevate water in the global change discussions that are had by that are held by the UN, for example, the COP meetings that happen every year, the Bonn Climate Conference that happens every year. There's Climate Week in New York that's happening in a couple of weeks. We need to elevate the discussion of water and the rapidly changing water availability, rapidly increasing water security, and all the issues that are associated with it, to the level of carbon dioxide. That's what I would like to see happen, and that's one thing that I'm working hard to do.
Yes, you've been working, studying hidden water reserves for a long time. What are you working on next, and where do you see the next frontier?
That's an excellent question, because I feel like with this paper, I've really sort of made the transition to the action phase of my career. Scientifically, we're always trying to improve our methods. We're trying to bring together more and more satellites. There's higher resolution satellites now available through the private sector. So we're trying to combine those things also with machine learning and AI to do the best job we possibly can. So we're always working on that. We're always working on improving our resolution in space and time so that we can get down to the scale, say a 1 kilometer scale, at which water management decisions are made around the world. We are always working very carefully and very hard with stakeholders, with our departments of water resources, whether I've lived both in California and Arizona. So trying to do a lot locally and then globally, again, really turning my attention to and trying to build community and connect communities that are trying to elevate the awareness of water and elevate its stature within these global climate discussions.
From Arizona, we've been speaking with Dr. Jay Famiglietti. And Jay helped publish a revealing new study titled Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise. You can find links, notes, and quotes in my show blog every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Jay, thank you so much for sharing time with our listeners.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio EcoShock.